I was recording for this video a couple nights ago, and I was like talking kind of soft. I was like, whoever lives on the East Coast of the US, you're probably asleep, but I'm not. And then I get all these messages like, you should do ASMR, and you should like, you should do a sleep podcast. Like, just tell people stories to sleep. And I was like, what in the, like, ASMR? No, that's not me. But yeah, I never would have narrated something in my life if it wasn't for this documentary. So that's kind of a funny aspect of like middle-aged women asking me to read them books to sleep. Okay. Hey, I don't know if that's gonna happen.
Where the money is.
You know, maybe I'll become the next Travis Myers podcaster. Welcome to film, where I talk really soft and talk about film.
Man, I got chills. Usually, I've heard that you find your passion in strange ways, and this might be the next avenue for you, the ASMR.
There's probably definitely something there.
You know, if you started a Patreon, I bet it could be very lucrative for you.
I'll fund my next short film with whispers.
I'm already enjoying this. This is great.
Here's some post-it notes. Sorry, I was practicing my ASMR with some post-it notes. Welcome to the Hometown Hollywood Podcast, where you can find advice, inspiration, and strategies for success from talented people that are making a name for themselves inside the film industry, but also outside of major film cities. Here's your host, Travis Myers.
Hey, my name is Travis Myers, and this is the Hometown Hollywood Podcast. Today's guest is Justin Robinson, a writer and director in Charlotte, North Carolina. I don't know if I have ever or will meet anyone else quite like Justin. After watching and crying through his documentary, My Brother Jordan, which now has over 11 million views and is getting crazy attention all over the world, I started watching tons of his other sketches and short films, and I knew that I had to get him on the show. If you haven't seen the doc, I would recommend that you watch it as soon as possible. He has a crazy journey, and he's basically worked with all of my childhood filmmaking heroes through the years. If you need some motivation to work harder and be more intentional in life and in your film career, look no further than the soothing, metaphor-filled advice Justin gives in the show. Also, people often confuse him with the Colombian singer Maluma, so I thought this background music would be appropriate. In this interview, you'll learn about Justin's crazy work ethic and his sleep struggles, potential ventures in ASMR, working with YouTube legends like Jamie Costa, Olin Rogers, Brett Driver, and more, where to seek inspiration for great dialogue, how to make filmmaking personal, his strange first encounter with Ryan Conley and the Film Riot gang, Josh Conley's untapped acting potential, Art the Fart, Matthew McConaughey in a desert writing cabin, and how he's handling all the well-deserved success of My Brother Jordan. Justin is a great guy. It was an honor to hear about his journey, and I learned a ton from this interview. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did, so let's get right into the show. Justin, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks for having me, man.
You obviously have a lot going on right now. Your documentary is blowing up about your brother, My Brother Jordan. And I just want to say thank you for letting me, well, Texas came out, letting me meet your brother through that video. I am not ashamed to say that I ugly cried through it. And I don't know if I've been that touched by a documentary in a very long time. It made me want to be more intentional with my family, relationships, friends, and so just want to say thanks.
Absolutely, man.
So we will get into that. Once I was doing my homework, I noticed that you have an interesting story. Let's talk about the early work. I did a deep dive. I looked way back in the YouTube channel. I went from bedtime stories, The Cup. And then I see, like, every once in a while, like, whoa, my gosh, you've worked with Jamie Costa and Olin Rogers and Brett Driver. And how did you meet all these people? How did you get started in filmmaking?
And all three of those guys are great dudes. Filmmaking has allowed me to meet most people that I work with or that I'm friends with in the film industry circle. So grew up very sheltered from movies, so I didn't have a palette for directing or filmmaking or screenwriting. Didn't even know what that was. You know, didn't watch even enough movies to realize what was happening. It was just a sheltered p- pastor's kid, homeschool, 90s life of G movies. So in high school, middle school, really, we had a VHS camera, started dabbling. You know, I was editing VHS to VHS tape and illegally downloading Space Jam music from LimeWire in like 2004, editing on Pinnacle Plus 9 that one of my older brothers somehow got from his college, and just kind of fell in love with it. And, you know, again, wasn't making like films by any means, but grew up quite a bit when my brother died right before my senior year of high school. 11 days before I was 18, and my dream at that point was to play college basketball. But when he died, basketball kind of died with him, at least for many years. And so I kind of turned to filmmaking because basketball was something that made sense to me, in the sense of, to be good at it, you kind of have to be the last person on the court, or at least I would. Some people probably are more naturally gifted, but I had to work really hard, and I was shorter than everybody, but mentally I was way taller than everybody. I was very confident. I talked a lot of trash. And, you know, because I was playing varsity, at least in the homeschool, private Christian school level in the sixth grade. So I was having, a taste of 6'8" people when I'm like 4'9". So you can't exist on that court without being confident. And so I had this confidence built from basketball, and I had this awareness of people, and I had this awareness of what people needed to succeed as a teammate. And so when my brother died and my life up to that point was mostly basketball, the film kind of replaced it. And so the same ways that I thought about basketball, I think about filmmaking. And, you know, you have to work hard. I have to work hard. I have to be the last one on the court, so to speak. So then, you know, YouTube was in its, you know, golden era at that point. So made a YouTube channel, started making sketches, stupid, silly things where I could convince people to come and film with me, because nobody I knew was interested in film. It was just me. And so people coming around just for me to be, you know, the crazy homeschool kid who will do anything for the film. And then, you know, I started making more and more, went to college, was a horrible student, although I did pass. I was writing sketches and scripts in my classes, and I grew up hating school, hating writing, was really bad at reading, couldn't, like, I don't know if it's reading comprehension or like dyslexia, or, you know, I don't know. I'm sure you can identify it with an acronym that makes sense to the science or mental world. Like, people often ask me in relation to my brother's death or just life, they're like, have you ever gotten therapy? I'm like, I haven't actually. I probably should in a lot of ways, but I would, the therapist would need therapy if they gave me therapy. So all that to
it's
be
like
said,
exception of therapy.
Yeah, it would. It'd be like, are you, it's like you go to a chiropractor and you're like, hey, make sure that you get your back popped after you work on me. So that's kind of how I feel. But so filmmaking just became a thing that I put everything into. I could not think about it. And so full circle from hating school and writing and reading and learning, not learning, but learning stuff I don't want to learn, I was into film 24/7, breathing it. And so I made this really terrible World War II film, which is private on YouTube. I know you did a deep dive, but there are a few things that people shouldn't see.
Oh, I hacked your channel.
Oh, did you?
No,
oh,
I'm kidding.
Like, there's probably a way. It was online for quite a while. It somehow got a lot of views. Like, it was over 1 million views, and the comments were just all over the place. Yeah, it was quite entertaining. But anyways, so I made that film, and to go back to meeting Jamie Costa, I went to the college that he went to. And he found me in the cafeteria after I had made that film. And he said, hey, I saw your film, and I think I want to be an actor, and would love if you ever. And we just hit it off, became friends. And then he was dabbling in impressions and kind of being known as the funny guy rather than an actor. Oh, my God. And we both hated school to the 10th degree. And so any laughter, any like, hey, just can George Bush give me a call on the phone and tell me, you know, what my class assignment is instead of my teacher, or can Johnny Depp or Jack Sparrow rather give me a call? And so we just kind of helped each other survive college. We both almost dropped out, but so he was so talented and hadn't had any content online. And I love comedy, although I don't make a lot of it at this point. We started making sketches, and I would write content for him because it was so easy. Because like him, although I'm not an impressionist or actor, I can think like whoever that character is should think like. So we created this like original grandma character who smokes like 8 packs a day. And so it's easy to think of all the very un-G-rated things that she would think and say about. She's unfiltered. And so we made like 7 or 8 sketches in a summer. And then he was in most of the things I did. And then, gosh, how I met Olin Rogers was he was doing a web series on YouTube called Pop Rocket.
Yes.
This is like 2011. And an actor friend of his knew me through my stunt work. And Olin apparently posted a casting call, a stunt guy call, and this guy recommended me. Olin gave me a call and was like, are you ready to like sweat like you're in hell? Because we were in Thomaston, Georgia in the summer. And he's like, I need to, like, he was basically double checking that I wasn't going to be a diva. And, you know, I had was happy to be there. So I said, yeah, let's go. And I went and worked on this thing in Thomaston, Georgia. And there was like, I don't know, 12 of us, but most of them were just like, I think glad to be there, but they were more like fanboys of Olin rather than crew members that could actually make films. And so I was kind of, I turned into the gaffer slash, you know, DP slash all the things. And me and Olin just hit it off, and Brett Driver was there. So we, of course, hit it off, and I ended up slicing my arm, getting stitches. I had to go to the ER on that thing.
My gosh.
We're shooting at this really, you know, most indie filmmakers have shot at like an abandoned mill. This was like the worst abandoned mill you could shoot at. Like, there was a stench, the air we breathed probably could have killed us. And so I was rigging some light, and I caught a window that was like a shark tooth, didn't even feel it. And then just blood was pouring out. So,
wow.
But yeah, so I've been friends with Olin ever since. And then I shot a bunch of his sketches back in that same era. I drive up to Nashville and, you know, just help him shoot his insane stuff. And so we've been friends through the years, and same with Brett and Jamie to this day. And yeah, Jamie, I'll still request, like on my birthday, Jamie will give me a voicemail from this other character called Dad, who's like the dad who, you know, you never met, and he always asks his son for money, and he's always trying to steal from people. And it's a very, very funny thing, but that's kind of like a love language of ours is humor and writing good material. So all that to be said, that's where the YouTube era days led me to Vimeo and making not just sketches, but more serious, quote unquote, short films. And I'm on the path to hopefully write and direct feature films one day. That's the goal. That's the dream. And
that's the dream.
And hopefully, you know, genreless films to where I can do some funny stuff as well. Most of the stuff I do is pretty dark, heavier, serious, but I do love comedy too. But anyways, that's kind of the full circle of all those, the trio of those guys.
Man, that's amazing. I know that Jamie Costa is really good at impressions and doing characters. And,
mm-hmm.
But that grandma character I saw in your behind the scenes of Number 14, you also do a pretty, you do that character justice as well.
Yeah, we did it together. We had acting class. It was a theater acting class, which I think helped us have an outlet for insanity, although we hated most of the material that we had to do. But we became really tight when we did, I don't know if it was like The Death of a Salesman or something where we were British. I can't remember. Anybody who's a theater person, sorry if I'm making a fool of myself, but it was something where either we chose or the material said that we were British, and we basically like just had fun with it. And like our acting teacher didn't even care that we were like, we were performing the scene, but we were just genuinely having fun. And that was like the truest acting experience I've ever had, where we were just truly reacting off of each other. And that was kind of in that era of where we were solidifying our friendship and our kind of like ability to be insane and stuff like that. But yeah, he's so gifted. And in that era too, he was trying to also become a dramatic actor, a serious actor, and not just be known as the guy that, you know, people see. It's like a dog. Hey, do a trick, shakes, you know, roll over. And yeah. Jamie's not a dog, although he would be a great friend if he was a dog in another life. But so it was kind of in that era. So we would shoot like a grandma sketch, but then we would also shoot like the most, you know, serious high school mercenary film that we could do at the time, or college student mercenary film. But yeah, he's a really talented guy. That sky is literally the limit. And I don't think that's a cliche to say that for him.
Well, you're saying like you enjoy humor and, if you look at your YouTube channel, it's one video that is near and dear to my heart, which is Yellow Death. And then I would invite the listeners to look at that one if they can. Maybe I'll leave it a surprise. But it's a pretty fun, especially from the South where you like, because where I live, there's a ton of pine trees, and that's so true. And I've been thinking, like, someone needs to do a video about this. And then I found out it was already been done.
Mm.
And there's no way to top that. But then you go from that to Number 14, which is a really gritty action movie where you break everything in that building. Where do you get your motivation, and where do you seek and find inspiration for your films?
Oh, man. I think Stephen King gave the best answer to that at like some event where he was like, if I knew that answer, I would go and camp out and get all of the ethereal stories and capture them. But for me, I don't know. I mean, I've just had somewhat of a peculiar life and bizarre in a lot of ways. And I've meet a lot of peculiar and bizarre people, heartfelt or not. And for me, since I was a little kid, I was just a sponge. Wherever I was, if it was church, a basketball game, I just indirectly understood people, and I could see insecurity. I could see confidence. I could see someone lying. And, you know, it wasn't someone where it was a super obvious lie. I just, for whatever reason, just the intuition of like a 6-year-old knew that a 45-year-old guy just lied to his wife at church. And you're like, huh, for whatever reason, I just know that you lied. And like, you can't convince me that you didn't. And I'm not even a part of that conversation. It was just this weird, like, you know, backwards superpower that's like a blessing and a curse. So I was just a very intuitive kid who, I think in the culture of humanity, we only see the negative, or we only see the positive, or people who see the positive are fearful, terrified to see the negative. And people who see the negative are negative Nancys, and they're, you know, they don't see the positive. And I think at an early age, I was able to see both equally. And granted, speaking about one or the other, the negative is usually harder hitting, you know, because if you're the pilot of that conversation, it's a soft landing to say good job. But if I have to tell you, hey man, you need to take a step back, just so you know, this is kind of what just happened that you didn't realize, that's a hard landing. You got to fasten your seatbelt, especially for the world that we live in. We don't live in a world where we're honest most of the time. So I was this, to what most people would assume, a harsh, honest person, I wasn't the kid who asked your parents, why this? Why does this happen? And they answer and go, well, why this? I just was quiet and intuitive to a degree. I mean, I was rambunctious as a kid, but mentally I was quiet. So when film came in my life, all of this intuition and experience and sponge kind of, you know, I squeezed it out, and it came out through films and through scripts. And so everything I write comes from, you know, very personal experience. For example, earlier this year, right before COVID, I was writing a script about a heavyset Baptist church pianist who wasn't very good at piano, but man, she played her heart out every Sunday. And it's like this dark comedy where there's this like political choir director, a lady who dyes her hair and wants to be 40 when she's 50. She fires this lady, the pianist named Betty, to get her beauty pageant granddaughter to take her place. So Betty, the church pianist, in a fuss, tries to poison the potluck on her way out. So it's this like small town 90s quirky thing that kind of goes all over the place. And there was a part of the film where, and I haven't made this yet, I've written the script, where I couldn't quite find the inn. And it was a Sunday morning. This is right when COVID hit. This is like early March, I think, or at least where it started to be substantial where I live, where shutdowns and stuff. And so someone knocks on the door, and I get up and I'm like, oh, did someone knock on the door? It's like 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning. They knock again. I go to the door, swing open the door, aggressively so, kind of on accident, which terrifies these two middle-aged black guys that are in trench coats and like fedoras, like they're, you know, in Goodfellas in like 1940. But they almost look similar. Like they look like twin brothers, and they're just standing there. And I'm like, wow, did I just like walk into a Coen Brothers movie? What? And the guy, since I startled him by opening the door, he kind of like starts to talk and then pauses and then almost goes back to one, so to speak. And then like if a director calls action, he goes again and he's like, hi, my name is Kevin. And he goes to the spiel that he's like a Jehovah's Witness or something. I couldn't really understand. And I just was like, he asked me something like, where do people go in the afterlife or something like that? And I was super busy that morning. And often if it's a Mormon or whoever, I'll be interested enough just to hear what they have to say just because it's material. Well, for whatever reason, I was like, man, I'm not going to answer your question. Like, I'm not interested. And I never respond that way. And it kind of shocked him. And then I shut the door and I'm like, oh man, I just missed an opportunity to hear this great spiel or to get this great pamphlet. And not to belittle what they're doing or Jehovah's Witnesses or whoever, but I don't remember who they were. But all that to say, those two guys were became a part of that film I was writing in a way that connected everything. So it's like everything that happens to me, as weird as people soliciting in an apartment where you're not allowed to on a Sunday morning, mind you, and who knocks twice. So I'm like, bro, you knock twice, man. That's you're telling me things. Don't tell me things. So my life is kind of like that. You know, I'll be walking around and some random Native American guy will come sit down next to me at Moe's and then talk to me for 2 hours, how he's an exorcist and he's almost killed people and whether half of it's true or it's he's on drugs. It's all great information. So the motivation is kind of inspired by just the crazy life experiences I have and how I can try to turn them into something, or also just the way that I view the world. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot in between, but wow. My life presents me a lot of material, and my childhood has presented me a wealth of material for the rest of my film career. You know, if you make 10 movies, if you're lucky, or whatever it is, I could write all of what I've lived and that would be enough. Granted, it would be a lot of films in like the 90s era and a genreless genre, but that's kind of, I don't have the greatest answer, but just if you were with me for like a weekend, you would meet some random people that you would never meet. And that's just kind of the way that I go. And I have that face.
You're just
I have a
magnet for those people, I guess.
I usually try to jot down these stories. So I think it's just, I'm a little crazy, so I attract the crazies, but that's the short answer to your question. I don't know.
So write it down. I'm going to take notes, and that's a personal note for me. Write down the crazy experiences.
Yeah, man, I have a Google Doc of just dialogue I hear in real life. And
oh, really?
Yeah, it's all over the place. Even a second AC friend of mine, we were on a movie a couple weeks ago, and he grew up in Minnesota. And someone was like, oh yeah, the state of all the lakes, 10,000 lakes. And he's like, yeah, but actually I lived in the only county in Minnesota that didn't actually have a lake. So yes, there's 10,000. And so I was like, oh my God, that's genius. Like that tells me so much about that character. And so of course I write that down. So it's just stuff like that I keep my ears open, because when people say things, it's something I wouldn't have said. And as a writer, I want to write things that I wouldn't say. So it's a practice in being in tune with the world, and actually the world speaks really good dialogue. So if anyone likes the dialogue, most of it I've heard in real life. So
I was one thing I wanted to talk about is the dialogue in your films, and going from your older videos to now, I think that's one thing I can really see shine is the dialogue and how real and off the wall it can be. One of my favorite lines in, what was the film? Snowbirds. Mm. You can't fix it. It's orange.
I didn't actually. I wrote it in the moment. It wasn't in the script. It was just improv.
Really?
Yeah. I grew up mainly in Florida for my middle school, high school, and then I moved to South Carolina. And at that point in my life, I had not experienced pollen. And so that's where Yellow Death came from, which is a sketch about pollen, because it turned me into like a zombie from The Walking Dead, truly like bloodshot, yellow eyes, truly yellow, like something I had never experienced, to where, you know, I wanted to rip my eyes out and snot and itchy. And it was just like, who wants to live here? This is the worst thing ever. So I made a sketch called Yellow Death. But yes, Snowbirds was something where also when I moved to South Carolina, the age group I was in and my brother were in was like high school and college guys in Clemson and South Carolina. Everyone kind of dressed the same. They wore like really short Docker khaki shorts. They'd wear like the boat Sperry shoes and like a Costa. I don't know what the hat that doesn't have the top on it. It's just the bill.
Oh yeah.
And then they'd have, you know, this, like, everybody was the same, and I'm not hating on that look, but everyone looked like carbon copies of each other. And in Florida, you got your surfer bros, you got your dudes wearing FUBU, you got your homeschoolers wearing denim for days. And then you got, you know, everybody else in between. And there's kind of diversity there. And when I was like, wow, everyone looks the same. So that was the inspiration for Josh Conley's character was to wear Clemson Orange, like an alumni who lets everyone know that he went to Clemson. And so then in the moment we were just improvising, and that all of the years of experience I've had being around people that went to Clemson and Carolina, I go, it's orange, you can't fix it. But yeah, so that was a fun line. Josh just delivered it. The moment I just in the moment said, Josh, say it's orange, you can't fix it, he busted laughing. So we had fun with it. And so some stuff like that is magical, but I wish I had put it in the script. It might not have been as funny because it was so organic when Josh delivered it.
I think Josh is underrated. Wow. There goes puberty again. 28 years old.
Been there. Happening.
I think Josh is so underrated as an actor. I love everything he does. And one day you should write a movie for him just as the main character. Being that, he can even be that same character. And I would just watch it on repeat.
Yeah, he is brilliant. He doesn't act in a lot of stuff. He's mainly been in Film Riot for good reason. And even the way I met them, it was this project, man, years ago, 2013, where he was supposed to be one of the main characters. I think his character name was Charlie, and it was this really like aggressive, it was a zombie movie, and he was a guy who shot like a bow and arrow, something like that. Yeah. And he never got to play it. And so whenever I interact with Josh, we'll be messing with each other, and I always joke that like whenever he does something funny, which is usually on the first go, I act as if I'm the director, and I'm like, I'm not shooting anything else, I'm moving on, that's the one, because he's so good at just being in the moment. You look at him and he'll just give you a face and you're like, we're not even talking about filming, I just go, that's the one, Josh, that's your one take type of guy. But he has a wealth of like intensity that's kind of untouched acting wise. He has a lot of material that he could share with the world, I think, eventually. So I hope he acts more. I hope Film Riot gives him more opportunities. But he's also someone that I don't think a lot of people think to, hey, Josh, will you be in my film? And he's a gem in every way. But he is also someone that I think could play a lot of characters. I mean, he does on Film Riot, but in more like narrative movie sense, I think he could. I know he could.
He's getting a lot of practice. And you segued right into my next question is about Film Riot. And Film Riot and Olin Rogers were like my heroes in the film world. And then I was like, dang, this guy has worked with both of my heroes. So we've explained how you met Olin Rogers. How did you meet the Film Riot crew to the point where you were part of the crew?
Yeah. So I Googled Ryan's address. I drove to Texas, knocked on his window and said, let's be friends. I'm kidding. I wish that was our story. In high school.
At this point, I would believe it. You could have sold me on it.
Yeah. I'm sure some kids have tried to do that. But I think it was late high school, back when, you know, my brother had died and I had no film mentors or anybody. I just had YouTube and Vimeo and Film Riot and Olin included, even the balloon shop days. I had watch them, subscribe, of course. So anybody that I thought was a respectable filmmaker that I could learn from, I watched. And so that was in maybe 2009, I think Film Riot started. Could be wrong, but so in that era of like senior in high school, college, I watched Film Riot. And so when I started making sketches, got a Twitter, social media just for filmmaking sake, and I would tweet Ryan and say, hey, I made this sketch, you know, would love your notes on it. Because I was looking to get better. I wasn't looking to get a pat on the back. And he'd be like, oh, I love this. You know, your pacing is good, but maybe, you know, this. And it wasn't like the most harsh feedback. I mean, he's not going to ruin somebody's life on Twitter. But, and to my surprise.
At least not on Twitter.
Yeah, at least not on Twitter. And he doesn't have that type of heart either way. He's a good-hearted guy. But so he was kind enough to reply to most of the things that I sent him. And to my surprise, years later, when I made that short film number 14, which was just to have material for a stunt reel. So I wrote this little thing. I shaved my head and grew a beard out and looked like Hugh Jackman in Les Mis just to shoot this thing. And to my surprise, from all the sketches I had sent Ryan, I don't know if he subscribed or followed me on Twitter or whatever, but he kind of followed me in the unsocial media sense, I guess. So when I released number 14, he, I think it was on Twitter, messaged me or emailed me. It was like, we need to work together. And that was all he said. Wow. And he posted the short film. And I was like, oh, wow. That was back when like nobody shared much of, I think, short film in general. And it wasn't as much of a mass sharing experience in my own. I never asked anybody to share it. So it was a obviously sharing helps, but I didn't care if you did or didn't. But when Ryan did, I was like, oh, wow, he saw it. That's cool. And so he emailed me. That was spring of 2013. We were supposed to do that film Outsiders, which is the reason he flew me to Texas to direct the behind the scenes, which was the film Josh was going to be in. And
this makes sense.
Yeah, I had never even Skyped them. We just emailed. He flew me to Texas. I land. Ryan picks me up and he just has a look on his face and he's like, what's the worst news you think I could tell you? And I'm relating to his film. And I'm like, oh man, you lost your location. It's like a one location movie. He's like, now worse. I was like, did your actors fault? He's like, worse. I was like, money? He's like, yeah. So money didn't come through. The film was canceled while I was on the flight. And I was supposed to be in Texas for like 2 weeks. And so they had pretty much caught everybody who was flying in to do this film before they got on the flight, except me and this crazy, brilliant composer, Daniel James from England. So it was me and him at Ryan's house with a bunch of gear for like 2 weeks. So we kind of hang out and have an emotional...
Kids in a candy shop.
Yeah. Yeah, Daniel, I think, was the fire that he just wanted to do something. He'd wake up in the morning and scream from the second story, y'all beautiful, y'all beautiful. Like every morning, he would hold up his iPad with the song. Like it was like the Simba moment. And like, man, that's him like sober, I think. So he was just a energetic cat, which is why he makes such amazing music. But anyways, we were there after a couple of days of like hugging it out that this film was canceled. They ended up, long story short, making the short film Proximity, which was based on, hey, we're here, let's make something. I acted in it. I got drowned in it. We had a blast. It was a crew of hardly anybody. It was like me and Ryan's sisters. That was the crew. Yeah. And Wayne, a guy who drove from Jacksonville just to come help, and he just held the boom pole, who ended up being a really great, awesome friend of both Film Riot and myself. And so that was us. That was us making this movie. And then we just became friends. I flew back and we kept in touch. And then years later, January 2016, I flew to Texas to shoot some interviews for my documentary. And I was staying with Ryan and we were talking, and I've been freelance since college and shot weddings in the DSLR days in college, and then was ACing and gripping and PAing and second ADing and all these things on features. And he's like, what's next? I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know. And then a few months later, he's like, why don't you come work for me? I don't really have a job for you, but you know, you could just like, we were just more friends than we were like colleagues or anything else. Yeah. And so then let's see, June 2016, I moved myself to Texas and worked full time with Film Riot until almost 2018. And I work part time with him now. And he has executively produced the last two short films I've done. And of course, Josh was in the last short film I did. So we text almost daily. We've been amazing friends. And I said in the BTS of one of the last short films I made that if we didn't make films, we would still be friends. And so we're both, all three, just have a level of insanity that, you know, I think is the reason the friendship works as well as it does. But it started for me as a fan of Film Riot and someone who was also trying to figure it out and who was also busting their butt to try and figure it out and just making stuff. So I respected them. And I think there was a mutual respect that there was less talk about doing something and just doing it. You know, a lot of people are like to talk about it instead of just being about it. And
yeah,
I think we both connected on that level. So that resulted in us all working in an office in Texas. And so that's all that matters right now.
That's amazing. You talked a little bit about that, or about this next topic. Do you ever stop? From what I hear in the documentary and just seeing on your social media, like, hey, I'm up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning editing, and I've been editing this documentary for the past few months, just nonstop. What motivates you to just keep going like that? Because it seems like you just keep working and working, and I'm not sure how much you actually sleep.
I don't sleep enough, I know that. I don't have any major health issues, so I have chronic back pain and migraines, so I guess I do have some health issues, but I don't sleep a lot, and I've not usually out of intentionality, I can't, and so I don't find the time valuable to sit on my back in the dark. Because it's really my mind. I actually did a sleep, like I went to a sleep doctor a few months ago just to see, but you can probably ask my wife if you ever meet her about what it's like. But yeah, I don't stop well. I don't rest well. to a degree. I don't think an unhealthy degree. I just am naturally, I don't need a lot of sleep, and I'm naturally kind of energetic. But, you know, I just turned 30 this year. So there are times where, like, occasionally my body will shut down and it'll be like 6 p.m. or 3 p.m. where, like, I have control of my mind and my body like a normal human being. But then sometimes you're like, oh, there's something else. Like somebody, you know, it's the Office episode where like Pam pulls Michael Scott's batteries out just to get him to shut up. And she jokingly goes behind him and is like, oh, I took your bat. It's kind of like that. So occasionally I shut down, but normally I go pretty hard. I don't stay up as late as I used to. Like in college, I'd rock like 3 hours of sleep. I need like four.
Oh my gosh.
Four and a half. Maybe five to like exist well. Occasionally I do a Red Bull on features just because the grind of a feature is tough, and often the dialogue will put you to sleep when you're working on movies that aren't so great. So that makes it more difficult when you rock no sleep and then you're sitting there like, oh my God, it physically hurt. I got a rash from how bad this movie is. But, you know, I'm physically reacting to this experience. But you sit there and try to learn and again, see both sides. I'm trying to be better about it just because I'm a husband and, you know, she works a full-time job. So if I'm home working, I'll work usually until she gets home, and then we hang for a few hours, and depending on what she wants to do, I'll go back to it or whatever. But there are certain days or like phases where if I'm writing a feature, my laptop doesn't turn off until I finish the feature. So it's like extra motivation to continue instead of, I don't know. And normally I try to write pretty quick. When I'm in it, I'm in it. So I try not to mess around. When I'm working, I'm not dabbling. And so when I don't know, I'm figuring it out. The structure of my writing I've created to where I go like month to month. So let's say November, I'm going to work on this feature idea about this. And my goal is to get it to an outline phase, or say it's a short film, I'm going to get it to some sort of draft, first, third, fifth draft, to where when December comes, I don't touch it anymore. I go to the next thing. So then I go in the research phase of the next thing, so that by April of next year, I have, you know, whatever the math is, five things, four things, six things that are readable instead of just these ethereal, invisible ideas of like, yeah, I got this sci-fi idea and I got this fantasy idea. And then you're like, okay, cool. But like, have you written it? And you're like, I mean, in my head. So I'm not trying to be that type of writer. I'm trying to be someone who, oh, it's literally behind me on the shelf. It's physical. It's, yeah. You know, I have the evidence of this crime that I've done. So I've tried to create a way for my brain to work. Everyone is different, so everyone has different ways. Some people like Google Chrome. Some people like Internet Explorer, Safari, whatever it is. Some people like Facebook, Instagram. I'm trying to figure out where to exist and put my crazy sleepless brain into something that can bring something to fruition in the best way as quick as possible and without, you know, wasting time. So I'm still learning. If I was wealthy, I would take more like writing trips and just disappear. I was listening to a podcast with Matthew McConaughey, who just wrote a memoir that released in October. That sounds super interesting just because he's a guy that I think also has crazy life experience and just decided to write about it. And what he did was like had all these stories for years. And I think it was during quarantine, if I'm correct, that he had talked to his wife about it. And she was like, you know what to do. So he basically went to wherever the desert is and just like got a, you know, Wi-Fi-less cabin and wrote for like 12 days at a time. And he would go back every couple months. And I think over the course of all these writing trips, he did like 52 days. So he wrote this book that's like 300 pages in 52 days of like specific all-in work. I mean, like no Wi-Fi, no power or something crazy. Like, I don't know if you go to that extreme, but that's something that really speaks to me, like going to the beach, but just basically writing and putting your toes in the sand is like a dream for me. So I'm still trying to figure that out, but that's a way that with my sleep schedule, with my life schedule, to where when I go hard, I go hard in the paint. So my writing has gotten faster. I don't know if it's gotten better, but I've been able to put more words on the page and speed up the process of being intentional. Just again, because, you know, we have only one life, and I'm not saying like, oh my God, write your scripts because you're going to die tomorrow. But I think a lot of people, you know, that might be true for some people, but people just live at least I've seen so many people live so passively and creatively passive to where they'll sacrifice their creative dreams to watch a bunch of B-level shows on Netflix. And I'm not saying you shouldn't veg out on Netflix every once in a while. I just think it's the same way. Like, you really want to be good at something, then you're going to have to sacrifice maybe watching as many things as you do to make things instead of always watching. And I know that's a balance, and I'm not guilt tripping anybody. I'm just speaking more to myself to figure out, what kind of sacrifice do you want to make? Do you go out on Saturday night with your friends to go to a restaurant and have a conversation that might not go anywhere? Or do you, you know, I don't know. I didn't grow up dating a lot, and I didn't grow up in the world of like online dating. So I picture a lot of people my age, you know, figuring that out. And for me, I wasn't very interested in that. So I had friends, but especially when I work on features, I'm not interested to go out after the movie. We've just had 12 hours together. I'm happy about that. But I'm going to go home and write. Or I'm going to go back to this terrible hotel and try to create something, just because that's the only time I have. And so I have to protect my mental wellness and my creative wellness. And socially, I think it's valuable too, to have boundaries for yourself and to know yourself. And so I'm still learning myself creatively. And
yeah,
relationally, but I do sacrifice a lot to make movies. And I think that's the way that I have to do it. And I think it's an important balance of life, because you don't want to be the guy that's a bad husband, but he's a great writer, and he's a bad filmmaker, but he's a great, you know, I want to do both. I want to do all of it.
Yeah.
And I want to do all of it well. So figuring it out.
Yeah. Both of those things take work.
Yeah.
You got to make sure that you work at it. I think that's advice. You said it might be hard to hear for some people. I think that's advice that I need to hear, and I need to take more seriously. So I appreciate you saying all that.
Yeah, man. And again, figuring out, I'm not a pro on any of this. I see so many people, and especially working at film, right? I got so many messages. I still get reached out to a lot of young, I don't want to say inspiring, because I'm not the biggest fan of that word, but people that want to make movies that maybe aren't making stuff that is substantial, or whatever you want to say it. I don't think I said that any better, but people that ask questions that are looking for like answers, instead of, not everybody can be Indiana Jones. You know, you might be like Indiana Smith, so you need to go do that. Indiana Johnson. And so people just looking for answers rather than like, hey, you kind of have to go through it too. Like, where did you start? Did you have a DSLR? Or did you start when, you know, Red was in? Did you start with an Epic? I started on VHS. That doesn't make me better or worse than you.
Yeah.
There's more options probably now for you to use gear wise. And so I don't know. I think it's just something that it takes a lot of work, and I don't think it's, work isn't attractive to people.
Yeah.
But I'm grateful enough to love screenwriting and filmmaking, so it's easier for me. But all that to say, a lot of the people that reach out, not all, but most, you can tell pretty quickly that they're not looking to sacrifice to make something. They're just trying to find a way. Like, hey, how did you write that cool thing? Was it 30 years of life, or did you just like think of it in 5 minutes and you're like, oh, this is my life's work? It might not be good, but that's why it's rich. So again, you do find like a guy I met through a random email. He saw a film I did. He's one of the most talented writers I know now. He's a young guy. Amazing. Like, super proud of him. And he's someone that, again, had great questions to begin with, but he was also just not interested in the idea of being a writer. He's writing stuff. That's great. And that's, you know, an anomaly in some ways, but that's someone that you're like, there it is. You're doing it. You're figuring it out. You're not trying to be Tarantino. You're not trying to be Wes Anderson. You're being who you are. You're certainly influenced by whoever. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's been cool to see, because of the reverse. I see so many people that are just hoping that someone can make their film for them, or write their film, or whatever. And I don't know. I see a lot of that. Yeah. I don't know if I'm communicating it effectively, but I feel like...
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of people, when they ask, like, hey, will you check out my film and let me know what you think? A lot of people have the idea that it's like, oh, this is the way I'm going to get discovered, and I've already got the skill set, and I don't need to work it at it.
Yeah.
Work at it. And I think that's a toxic way of thinking. And I probably have been guilty of that myself. And then I've never been proud of anything that I've done that I haven't worked my butt off for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like you were saying, that a lot of people don't like to hear that it takes a lot of work, but it does. And I think you can tell that you have really worked at it. And especially in some of your later films, like I keep going back to Snowbirds. I think the and grape soda, I really like that one as well. There's just so much emotion in those films. And I think that's one thing you like to focus on is deep emotion and showing that and having other people feel it through your films. I guess you've kind of already answered that. What inspires those types of work? But I guess it's real life experience because you've experienced that.
Yeah. And I think people that certain filmmakers that know me, most people that know me knew me after my brother died. And so filmmakers that see things in my films that are like definitely related to experiences, especially when people saw the documentary, like I share in the documentary the day my brother died that this couple had come to the door at the hospital and I wasn't really letting people see Jordan just with how bad he looked and he was not coherent. And they were like, do you need anything? And hundreds of people had asked that over the 13 months of Jordan's cancer to me or to our family. And I, no, I'm good. I don't need anything because I truly didn't. But for whatever reason, there was a smoothie place that opened in the hospital. And I said, you know what? There's a smoothie place. I would love that. And they're like, what flavor? I was like, well, I don't know. They brought up some purple smoothie and I don't know what flavor it was. And Jordan is dying. Like he had been dying for months and he hadn't eaten much. And I went over and gave him some of my smoothie and he couldn't even really see me, but he drank some. And I was so stoked about it. And so, that was in 2008, the day he died, made a short film summer of 2014 called Grape Soda. And it's about this connection this father had with a daughter over grape soda. And the daughter ends up passing away via cancer. And so the ripple effect through the marriage kind of affects their distance between each other. So it's kind of about a man and a wife post death of their young child. And one of my friends was like, oh, is it purple because of the smoothie? And you're like, yeah. So it's come from a real thing.
I didn't make that connection, but that's, it comes full circle.
Yeah. So it's stuff like that. That's very real to me. Like, you know, I think a father and daughter it could be hot dogs. It could be going to a Cubs game. It could be playing with Legos. It could be anything. So for a screenwriting question, that's what makes the connection to me. And so in that short film, something as small as like in every frame, there's something pink or purple that is from his daughter. Or in reference to his daughter. So every frame, there's something of reference. And so that's the connection was the purple smoothie. Because again, I don't know what flavor it was. I don't remember what it tasted like, but it was rich in purple. And so, and it also related to, again, when I grew up in Florida, you go to 7-Eleven, you get an icy or a Slurpee, as we called it. It was always so hot. That was always a refreshing thing. And there was this one gas station that was like this original unchain gas station that had these purple smoothies and we called them Roozies. I don't know why, because it wasn't related to drugs, but that was also a connection to the purple. So it's stuff like that even if it's just for me or for someone like that to go, hey, is that purple for this reason? And it's like, it is, but I mean, it's, I don't know. So that's again, kind of where a lot of stuff comes from is things like that and experiences I've had or like a smell of a room. You go to a church that smells as a kid and you wonder where that smell came from. And then, you know, so you write a film about a church that used to be a mortuary. I don't know, like haven't written that film, but that's kind of how my brain works. I have to figure it out. Because I think partially I would have been a good soldier. I would have been a crazy soldier. But I also think I would have been like a good private investigator or a cop. You know, I just either the intuition or the fearless insanity to be like, oh, there's a sound that's bad over there. I'll go over there without thinking. So I have to be careful.
People in those movies.
Yeah. Like someone I was saying on Instagram the other day and someone's like, oh yeah, you have a stalker. And they're like, oh, are you scared that he comes? I'd like, it'd be scarier for him to show up, you know, than for him to show up and me be scared just cause I would, you know, anyway. So a lot of life experience goes into the weird confrontations or the weird emotional places I've lived mentally and emotionally. It goes into the film and impacts. So that's why I think it's, in some ways, things like that. You can tell when you watch a film that something has been experienced by the filmmaker. Because often when you watch a filmmaker that you can tell their fingerprint, their DNA is on it or in it.
Yeah.
You can tell that experience enriched this film. No matter if the film is good or bad or whatever you think or feel about it. I appreciate when things feel lived. And that's not every movie because there's a lot of movies that you couldn't live that scenario. But if it makes sense to feel that this moved them at some point and hopefully it'll move the audience. I think that's contagious.
Yeah. I think that's beautiful. I like how it's, especially after watching the documentary, like I'll go back and watch some of your older films and I'll see pictures of your family like in Popeye. I saw the picture of your dad, and it just seems to fit in the scene.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Like, I think there was another picture of your brother in, I think there was one in Grape Soda as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, not only are you putting in your personal emotions because you've lived these type of experiences, but like,
yeah,
even visually, there are things that have your stamp on it, mm-hmm. I guess. So we can't leave without talking about the documentary. You posted it and it has just blown up. It is probably a few views away today from when we're recording this from 10 million views. How have you handled all this? What's it been like?
Pretty crazy, especially because it's only been 3 months online. I mean, from when I started making it, which was 2012, it took 8 years. It was 4 years after he died when I started. For retrospect, me and my older brother, Jordan, were very, very close. I think as close as we could have possibly ever been. He died of cancer, tragically. 4 years after that, I started making a documentary because everybody who then met me knew me as one thing, a filmmaker or the little brother of the guy who died. And no one knew me. They didn't know who I was. So I was a senior in high school and then I went to college and those were the personas I had. And both are most of the time very impersonal or distant from people because they don't know how to approach you.
Yeah.
Is, I love your films, or it's, oh my God, sorry. You know, people don't know what to say about death. There's no vernacular or language for death. It's just like, I know how you feel. And you're like, you do not, no human is the same. You do not, but you know, I'm not going to say that to them anyways. That's a book, but
yeah.
So started making this documentary. It took 8 years and just self-funded, shot with a 5D, shot with every type of camera from 2012 to now to get this thing done, and then finished it in January of this year after dieting from life and a lot of things. And then of course COVID hit. And so my only dream was to screen it for friends in person and to travel to Florida and all these places we live to kind of get to the chance to remember together and to see people and to kind of prove to people that it was as good as they remembered. Because a lot of things, you know, people die and people, oh, well, they were a great person when they're probably not the greatest person. And Jordan was not that way. It was stamped. The truth was the truth then, just as potent as it is now. So then I didn't know what to do with it. And so I was sending it to colleagues and friends saying, you know, what are your notes? And if there's any service abilities or connections you have, you know, feel free to pass them along. So there was a few options, but I don't have an agent or a manager or someone to sell the doc. So a couple things led to, you know, a couple conversations and phone calls and people that were like, you know, it's really, it's good. I just don't think it's, you know, universal enough. And I don't, you know, it's just, it's so personal. And I just, you know, not pitying me or pitying the film, but just kind of like, I knew what it was because I had, you know, almost 18 years of my life I'd spent with Jordan. So I knew what value he held with the people that graced his presence. And not to say he was some superstar. He was just a quiet, shy, bashful, super kind-hearted dude who would be the best teammate, the best worker, the most, you know, the person you can count on. All the things that you could fill with the English language that don't do it justice.
Yeah,
I made a film about that. So then when those conversations didn't lead to anything, I thought, I'm just going to put it on Vimeo, my personal Vimeo and YouTube for free, because I want it to be as accessible as possible. And I don't have ads, or my YouTube channel is not monetized, so it shouldn't pause your experience. You should be able to watch it. It's an hour and 3 minutes. And, you know, so I uploaded it on the 12-year anniversary of Jordan's death. And, you know, of course, a lot of people that knew me, knew him, and knew of this film's existence was anticipating it. So after like 2 weeks, it had around 20,000 views. And, you know, I was getting messages every day all over the place. And it was being shared more than anything I'd ever made. And I thought, wow, this is probably like everyone I know that shared it.
Yeah.
How crazy. 20,000 views for something this fast. Wow, that's amazing. And then it somehow got in the YouTube algorithm, which I don't know or understand or know anyone at YouTube, because in retrospect as well, I reached out to Vimeo because a short film I made, Grape Soda, years ago, got a staff pick on Vimeo. And when you get a staff pick, they email you and say, hey, here's this specific email that whenever you have work, send it to us first. And like, they'll decide if it's a staff pick.
Hmm.
Well, they've never decided anything I've made since then. And I sent them the doc and I know they don't do like hour long things, but they were like, no, it's really good, but no. And so it was kind of weird to like, I expected a no, but I'm like, you can't deny that this is made with heart. You can feel whatever, but this is palpable. I know this.
Well, shame on them, dadgummit.
I can't say I have hard feelings, but it was like, it was that kind of closing of the door.
I would have hard feelings.
Of the door. I was more like, really? Like, you can't, you know, but that's also like a political realm. I think the staff picks stuff. So I think people know each other. Anyways, that was kind of the process of people just shutting the door, saying no, or not giving me a direct no, just kind of being like, oh, okay, gotcha. So then when it went on the YouTube algorithm and started blowing up, I was like, oh man, I just got like 50,000 views today. And I had not experienced that. And funny enough, we talked about Olin earlier. He started texting me and he's like, dude, this is going to hit 2 million views. And this is really early on. And I was like, really? Wow. You think so? And he's like, dude, this has the legs to do 2 million easy. So he kind of kept up. And of course, Film Riot's done a lot of YouTube stuff. And a friend of mine, Sam Wickard, who's a really talented VFX wizard director. He's done some YouTube videos, 5 different videos called Chalk Warfare. And I've been able, or 4, sorry, I've been able to be in all of them. And they're these crazy, viral, fun action little films. And that one was uploaded a few months prior. And that has 20 million views at the moment. But the other videos they've done in the past have like 50 million.
Wow.
Everything they've ever done blows up. Funny enough, also full circle, Brett Driver's in the last one that we did, Chalk Warfare 4. And so he's texting me and they're like, dude, this is crazy. And I'm just kind of like riding the ride. You know, I'm just holding the reins, just trying to hold on. And Olin was like, I've never seen something catch on 2 weeks into its existence and go this big.
Wow.
And so I was blown away with 1 million, 2 million. And then it was doing like 500,000 views a day. So in two days, it'd be another million. And it was like, oh my gosh. And so I had kind of, you know, I'm not a marketing person, but I'm just one guy. And I made some marketing materials, screen grabs and stuff of stuff that as a fellow filmmaker, I would want to see, because that's the only thing I write and I make. I want to see this movie. I'm not trying to make some movie that someone might like. I want to see it. And that's how I made the documentary. And that's how I made some marketing stuff. But I made enough for like a month's worth. It was not nearly enough. And so it just started blowing up and millions of views. And social media was kind of going kind of crazy. And, you know, I've been grateful enough to do a few podcasts and talk about the doc or filmmaking or whatever. And now it's about to hit 10 million at any time. So I did a 10-minute recap video that I'll upload whenever it does hit, kind of talking about this 3-month journey of things that have happened. You know, like it went viral on TikTok and I had no prior experience with TikTok. So I never would have seen
the like, strange animal of a social media.
Dude, it is an army of people. It's basically what went viral is the hashtag My Brother Jordan. A bunch of like mainly high school girls all over the world started doing reaction videos, basically filming themselves crying, watching it. And then of course, some of those people who were doing it, I don't know who did it first, were very popular or verified or whatever. They got the blue check of humanity. And so then of course that became a fad or something. A lot of people started doing it. And so I made a TikTok to make a video saying thank you. So that became a part of this video, this experience. And it's kind of been crazy. But I think just because of COVID and because of the hard year it was for a lot of people, indirectly, people not seeing it in a public theater or on a streaming service, them getting to watch it in the privacy of their home and feel what they need to feel without being in the public eye of being worried if someone's watching them, but also people being available to watch it and being at home in quarantine or whatever has been a value to get the film seen. And so it was kind of an indirect thing of where the world just kind of needed to cry, because it was certainly wasn't a locally viewed film. It's been, you know, I'm getting messages from every country in the world every day. And, you know, of course it's biggest in the US, but that's been something that's just been like, wow, very, very, very blown away. So I have no idea where it's going to go. I mean, it's gotten almost 10 million in 3 months. And, you know, I feel kind of empty marketing wise of like, I don't know what else more. I gladly will talk about my brother, but, you know, people, I think people keep asking about the like secret sauce and you're like, oh, well, I mean, it just took me 8 years because I was trying to have a life and say no to everything. That was the majority of my time at Film Riot, was working on the documentary day and night and then going into work, coming home and banging my head on 450 hours of footage, trying to put it together by myself in this roach-filled apartment. So that's like my memory of Texas is just hours and hours of editing and killing roaches in the middle of the night. But yeah, so it's been an experience. So, but I'm happy people are seeing it and people are very receptive. And I think it's been encouraging to see people grow in empathy and, you know, being... Films have the power to do that, of course. They can grab you wherever you are and make you feel something you weren't prepared to feel. But I think people also doing that, but also I think being willing is a big part of that. Mm-hmm. And it's like being an actor, you know, you might not be able to get there, but if you're willing, it's going to at least help. If you're not willing, it might be harder to get to that emotional place. So I think the world has been willing in a lot of ways. There's still a lot of, you know, hate comments, but compared to the views, it's very little in comparison to what you would normally see on something with that many views. So it's been really, yeah, wild. That's all I can say, I guess.
I think what's also as impressive is that, like, there's videos on YouTube that get millions of views, but they're not all documentaries that are an hour long. They're like 5-minute videos. People are investing in this video. They're investing their time, and it's capturing their attention for an hour long. We know that people's attention spans are getting less and less every year. I've heard a goldfish has a longer attention span than a human being.
Oh, wow. Shout out to the goldfish. You want to watch the doc?
I don't know how they even test that. Now that I think about it, like, how do you know? Do you speak to the goldfish? Anyway, so
it's a good question.
I can tell that you've put in your whole heart and soul into this, and that shows, and that your hard work paid off. I saw somewhere that you were writing a book about it as well.
Yeah, trying to. So years ago, you know, in light of trying to document the crazy dialogue I hear in day-to-day life, and then when my brother died, I was fearful that memories would fade, which they naturally will, you know, in your brain, your body deteriorates. And I was fearful of that because the memories I had were so valuable to me and so impactful for me. I wanted to savor them. So I would jot down some stuff. And that was in my early, like, you know, it's horrible to think about, but I can't blame anyone in particular, but I kind of grew up in the generation or the place to where, like, if you journaled as a guy, you're gay, kind of a vibe. Yeah. And like that 90s, you know, thing where you're like, I don't know why that, like, but they'll also go watch Lord of the Rings and then they realize, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien wrote that. Like, writing is not something that is any type of bad thing. So I had this weird thing where writing was something that, like, people didn't do, or you weren't, I don't know, you had to be really particular or weird or had no other skills to be a writer.
Yeah.
It's just a weird psychological thing you kind of grew up around. But so I had kind of started writing, and I don't want to say journaling, but writing stuff about my brother and stories, just because in day to day, if we ever met up and had lunch and you asked about some crazy story, I want to be able to tell that story really well. And writing was a way to practice telling stories, getting the words from my brain to the paper or the brain to my lips. And I started writing a book and shelved it to make this documentary because it was just too time consuming. And I think that the time away was valuable to grow as a writer. And so I've come back to it and just as another thing. I know a lot of people be like, oh man, you made an hour long documentary, why would you tell that story again? And I wouldn't say I'm telling that story again. Also, I'm a storyteller and that's a story I have to tell. So you can mind your own business, but or like a script, read it or don't.
Yeah,
you totally don't have to be there if you don't want to, you know, the script will speak for itself. But all that to say, I'm revisiting it and something that I think there's value in it. And there's so much that I couldn't put in the documentary for time. And also about my own life and also how we were forged and how the perfection of our relationship was made and kept, I think is really important. And then also just funny stories, you know, there's just funny stories. Like, we grew up playing street hockey in Louisiana and this neighbor across our street, you know, there was the car parked in the garage. You never saw the car outside. There was no lights on. You never knew if anybody lived there. But if the puck or our ball went into this driveway, it was like the Sandlot where the ball goes over the fence and there's a dog or there's a monster.
Yes, Hercules.
And so we all, yeah, when the ball would go over there, everyone would stop and like, oh, who's going to go get it? And so as soon as you cross the threshold of this driveway, this old man named Art, who we called Art the Fart, would run out after you if you got on his property, even if you were just grabbing the ball 3 feet into his driveway or his grass. Get off my lawn! He'd just scream.
Wow.
And so it just was this part of our life to where you never saw lights on, you never knew, but he was right at the window. He was in the darkness, right in the shadow, watching. And, you know, now in retrospect, I wish I could get to know why he became such a fart, Art the Fart. And to be fair, my mom, who, you know, every word was a cuss word, fart was a cuss word. So she'd say, you have to say toot. And we're like, Mom, Art the Toot doesn't have the same ring to it. So I share stories like that, that are just from our childhood in Louisiana, where it's like we ran over an alligator with the car accidentally, just because that's the life, the life of a Louisiana person. So it's stuff that tells the tale of our life, and I think holds value just for me personally. And then also, if it's not for anything, if it doesn't get published, I can go back or share it with my kids one day, or people who want to know me can go and read these funny stories and tales of our childhood. So it's broken up in like short stories that are like the pivotal things, but it's also like it could be a companion piece to the documentary. So again, I don't know where it's going to be in the long run, but I think it's valuable for me as a human to write these things down, to tell these stories rather than hold on to them. Because again, a lot of stories are never told because they died with the teller that never told them. And I think it's valuable for us to share, because there will be pieces of that story that hold value for the listener, even if it's a laugh. And I think that laugh or that nugget that's taken is valuable in this world of a lot of different currencies. I think that's a great currency to share with another. I think it's rich in life and in pain and in love. And that's kind of where I'm at with the book. So I'm pretty early on, but it's also an exercise in writing, because I also don't just want to be a screenwriter. I don't just want to write scripts for me. I want to be a rounded writer to where I can write for other filmmakers that I respect.
Yeah.
And can write books, even if it's a memoir of sorts. I want my kids to be able to know who Uncle Jordan was. I want people to know who Jordan was, just because he's a guy that deserves that credit for how he lived. You know, you don't get an award for being a nice guy. You get an award for being the best, but they don't give you an award for being the best nice guy. So I'm writing this book, and I made that documentary to in some ways give him an award and props, because it wasn't something also where when he died, I all of a sudden was like, oh man, you were amazing. It was the whole time. Nothing was a surprise of his character or mine in that regard. It was, we both held each other up and respected each other to the highest degree and loved each other as much as we could humanly possible. So all that to say, I'm working on it.
That's amazing. Well, if you do, or when you do finish it, sign me up. I'm doing my pre-order now.
Thanks, man.
So you've got at least one customer, and I know I'm excited to read it and hear the stories, hear more about Art the Fart.
Art the Fart, man. Yeah, maybe I'll do like Instagram Live and I'll ASMR read some of the stories, some of the rough draft stories.
Dude, that's where it's at. And
I'll read my book. I'll do my, because that was one thing I shared with my wife. We were talking about it one day, and I was like, you know what? I think I should just do the audiobook version, because it's the story told from my perspective. And since I did the doc, it would be weird if someone else was reading these stories.
Yeah.
But maybe that'll get everyone's ASMR fix out of the way. So
dual purpose. Like, that is excellent marketing.
I can't promise I'm going to do that, but I can meet you in the middle. Here's an audiobook of my book.
I think you'd be amiss if you didn't read it. Especially knowing all of this.
Yeah. I hope it puts you to sleep.
Awesome. I don't want to take, I know you have 1,000 other things to do, but I have one last question.
Okay.
If you were going to give, I feel like this question is going to sound corny now that I'm reading it, but.
Bro, I'm homeschooled. Homeschooled. I've lived corny. Hit me up.
You've shaved the sideburns.
Oh, you bet. Higher than the ones before.
So if you're going to give advice to a younger you, what would you tell them? If it's someone wanting to get started into filmmaking, what advice would you give somebody?
Mm-hmm. I would tell my younger self. That would be an interesting conversation. I would say the confidence that you have is as valuable as you know. Don't let anybody devalue who you are, how you are. And if that all comes in the form of confidence, then be confident. That's a gift. It's a superpower. And wield it respectfully and honorably, but that is valuable. You don't become an NBA champion not being confident, you know, and I think that is valuable for me. I know confidence is an elusive thing for a lot of people, but that's something that's been valuable for me in a way to, you know what to do in certain things. Obviously, there's growth and a lot of things to learn about filmmaking and life and screenwriting, but instinctively, I think a lot of my work comes from that place. It's instinctual. You just know, you know, why don't, do you do a 3-act structure, an 8-act, a 4-act? And I just know where a story starts and I know where the middle is and I know where it should end. And again, I study all those things, but I think the aspect of, I don't know, your gut leading the way is something that is what I lead with. and it served me well in life and with people and also in film. So I think a lot of people not only need to learn more about screenwriting and filmmaking and technical things, but to learn more about themselves and how they think and to be comfortable and confident in that. Because if you're fearful to take a step forward without stepping on somebody's toes, the crack in the sidewalk or a leaf that fell off a tree, I think you're going to be the same type of filmmaker, because I never want to be a filmmaker that's this different personality, this different person than who I am as a person. I want to be Justin that makes the film. I'm not going to be Justin the filmmaker. And so I think learning life is more important than any technical things that I could learn. Obviously, the technical things hold such value. I need to know what a 35 millimeter looks like on the face, but
yeah,
I also need to learn how to be confident and to be kind and to be empathetic and to be decisive. So I think that would be something that I would tell myself. Like, that was kind of my relationship to Jordan. He was a confident kid, but he was nowhere externally confident. He was bashful. He was shy. You don't shoot a lot of threes as a high schooler if you don't have some sort of confidence, or you just have some sort of like memory loss. And so Jordan at times would grow in his timidness. And I'm a freshman at this time and he's a senior. Like, Jordan, you have, you know, your high school career is limited. You have 8 games left on the schedule. Shoot the ball fearlessly. Let it go. Let it go happily. And every once in a while, that was the push that Jordan needed. I was kind of the angel / demon on his shoulder, speaking things into his heart and into his brain from a good place. Of that was my role. I was 3 foot shorter and 3 years younger, but he saw me eye to eye. And so occasionally being that confidence for him was something that he needed. And also I needed a lot from him that wasn't those things. It was, hey, be kind. Don't be so quick to come to a realization. Even if it's the one you should come to, take some time because it's too quick for humanity. And so that's why we work so well. But that's why I'm figuring out how to do it myself. So I'm kind of my own motivational speaker from time to time, my own confidence building coach from time to time. I'm kind of who I am, who I was to Jordan, I have to be to myself now in some ways. But yeah, I don't know. That's a loaded question. That would be interesting to talk to yourself. But also I think the inspirational things are elusive because inspiration is like fleeting. It's like the weekend. It's there and people have a good time and they get wasted or do whatever the people do on weekends. But then when Monday comes, they don't know how to exist.
Yeah.
And I think that's what inspiration is for a lot of people in the creative world. And so I'm kind of not interested in inspiration, but if I had to replace that word, I would say more like motivated. I think that's more valuable for me as a word, to stay motivated. Huh. And life and death keeps me motivated, and love keeps me motivated, and people in my life keep me motivated, because life doesn't stop no matter who dies. And granted, life does stop no matter who dies, but to a degree it doesn't. And to continue in a way that gives life to a world that dies off and to loved ones that die off. I don't know. There's a lot there, but
yeah.
So to the inspirational quotes, I think they hold value for certain things. I think that's the 15th time I've said value. But it's the word of the day for me, I guess. I don't want people, especially in the creative world, to grow up being a dog chasing a car. You know, you're never going to catch it.
Yeah.
That car could kill you. I think you need to be careful what you bark at and make it intentional. And so that's kind of that's the path I'm on. A lot of dog metaphors too. I'm feeling it today. You know what I mean?
Bark, bark.
Jamie Costa be the best dog you could have. Don't know what kind of dog you would be, but it'd be a funny dog.
All right. Well, I don't want to take up more of your time. But I've really enjoyed having you on the show, and thanks for being here, man. I've learned a lot.
Yeah, man. Thanks for asking me. I really appreciate it.
And that's it. Thank you for listening. I hope this helps you do great work, be the artist you want to be, and helps you not be afraid to jump in with both feet and make things happen in your film community. Be sure to follow Justin on YouTube and Instagram, or I guess TikTok if that's your thing, to keep up to date with his latest work. I'll leave a bunch of links in the show notes. Hold up. I see what you're doing. You're trying to subscribe to the podcast while simultaneously writing a positive review on the show. Well, just letting you know, more people might find out about the show if you do that, so don't say I didn't warn you. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for our next awesome guest on the Hometown Hollywood podcast.
I have one story I feel like I have to share it with you, because I know you like interesting stories. When I was in Argentina, this lady came up to me And she seemed very distraught. Me and my companion were there just walking the streets, and she says, "Are you from the United States?" And I obviously don't look like I fit in the country because I'm a 6'6" whitest person you've ever met. I'm like, yeah, I'm from there. Like, when do you go back? She's like, like in 8 months or something like that. Like, why is that? Well, you, when you go back there, you need to tell Chris Angel to quit it. Like, Chris Angel? The magician? Like, yes, I have had it with him. I would show you the scars, but it would be inappropriate.
Oh, my God. It's wow, like, that's amazing.
I don't know what to say to you, but...
I'll let him know.
I can give you a pamphlet that you can...